This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, so many Americans have already voted, many more to come tomorrow as U.S. citizens head to the polls in the midterm elections. With that in mind, a few stories on our radar involving the midterm poll, and one has to do with several, the billionaire yep. donors and who they are supporting.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have two great stories here. And again, it's all about money in politics.
Big money, right?
And we're talking the big money. Amanda Albright joins us here. She's a wealth team reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. And Laura, let's start with the story you and Laura Davison wrote here. Billionaire GOP donors overwhelm Democrats. So you've got a chart in here. And like of the top 10 big billionaire political donors, there's eight supporting Republicans and two givers supporting Democrats. That's a little bit unbalanced. Where did that come from?
Yeah, so Republicans really have the edge with the billionaire contingent this midterm season. The top donors, the top 100 donors, according to Open Secrets, are, by and large backing Republican candidates in federal elections this year. They've really increased their giving from the last midterm cycle, which is just another sign of kind of the edge that the GOP has heading into, Tuesday. It's already here. So there's a lot of big names that have been really big donors. Ken Griffin, he's gotten a lot of press for his donations this year. And so Republicans really have gotten the edge from this group.
Why are they doing this?
So it's a great question. So some folks say that it's a desire to keep taxes low. So maybe they want a repeat of what happened under President Trump. Mm-hmm. And there's also kind of interestingly this theory that, billionaires might favor divided government. They might favor a stalemate. It's interesting.
Paul, we have a theme today.
Yes, we do.
So Elon and his tweets about, wanting divided government, I think that speaks to a desire for a little bit of a stalemate and not too much rocking of the boat in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and you have a great chart in here that just kind of shows as recently as 2016, when you're looking at the mega donors in terms of total dollars, it was pretty even between Democrats and Republicans. And then starting in 2018, the Republicans really in 2020 and 2022, the Republicans really stepped it up.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to who is galvanized in an election year. And so, it really just seems like this year Republicans, they have a lot more energy among this contingent getting donations.
Isn't it interesting because we talked about when Donald Trump came to the White House, how many small contributions, right? Individuals, normal, quote unquote, U.S. citizens just giving a few dollars, but there were lots of them. So it's interesting to see, the billionaires step up. We should point out that Michael R. Bloomberg, the majority owner of Bloomberg News, parent Bloomberg LP, of course, of Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg Radio, has been a major donor to Democratic candidates and causes this specific election cycle. Having said that, can we talk about one billionaire that both Paul and I are like, who is this dude? But anyway, can you tell us a little bit about a story that Tom Maloney wrote? He's a Bloomberg News editor, and he wrote about this billionaire trader, made money off of TikTok, which we know everybody's kind of after, including the GOP, and yet this dude is weighing his hopes, it feels like, on the GOP.
Yeah, so Tom had a really interesting story today about Jeff Yass, who's the founder of Susquehanna, which is a market-making firm. It's known for being a big trader of options and equities, and it's actually a competitor to Citadel, so Ken Griffin's Citadel. Mm-hmm. And so Yass has really made his $33 billion fortune from being an early backer of ByteDance, which is the developer of TikTok. What makes this story so interesting is that, you know, there's been bipartisan criticisms of TikTok in Congress, including by the White House. And so his story kind of points out that a lot of the Republican critics of TikTok, you know, their party is actually getting a lot of support from Jeff Yass, mm-hmm. Through his donations this year. And he's really stepped up his giving as well.
Yeah, there's another great chart in here that just shows, you know, over the last 10 years, he's gone from being, you know, a small giver to now $47 million just for this midterm. So it's this is something he's really stepped up and become much political. And I wasn't even aware of this gentleman and his wife, you know, just in general. But, you know, because Susquehanna is a big, big trading operation. Right. And then I'm sure his TikTok stake is worth a pretty penny. So he's really putting his money, I guess, where his mouth is.
Absolutely. And I should also point out that I believe he's Pennsylvania's richest resident. So he's also gotten involved in, you know, the local races there. So the Senate race and I believe the governor's race as well. So he's also getting involved in Pennsylvania politics. And that might also speak to, you know, why you haven't, heard of him. He's not a New York Wall Streeter who's, you know, really open about his beliefs.
What I love about stories like this is I feel like, Amanda, you know, the politics, the connections. Here's somebody who's made a lot of money, right? Has a big position still in ByteDance and TikTok. And yet he's hoping for a GOP win, is backing a lot, pouring a lot of money. And at the same time, the GOP are pretty critical of that company. So you wonder about the conversations, or they don't care.
Definitely.
Like, as many politicians, just show me the money is basically something, right, in terms of support for campaigns.
Absolutely. And the tech reporters at Bloomberg have done some great stories about TikTok's lobbying efforts in Congress. And so you have to wonder if that's come up in their conversations as well. TikTok is such an interesting story right now.
Yeah, there's just so many issues that are out there, right, that are kind of going before either congressmen or various politicians. And at the same time, it's also where a lot of the money comes when it comes to running a political campaign.
And Carol, guess who's still top of the list of those big donors?
Mr. Soros,
George Soros, $128 million so far in this cycle.
He has been for such a long time.
Such a long time, right?
It's pretty dramatic. Great reporting. So glad we could check in with you, and so timely, of course, with the midterms tomorrow. Amanda Albright, Wealth Team reporter at Bloomberg News here in our studio. Check out her stories at Amanda_Albright on Twitter. And then, of course, you can also go to Bloomberg.com for her story, as well as Tom Maloney's story. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Remember all those Russian super yachts being seized because of sanctions against the owners of the yachts? You know, we're talking about those Russian oligarchs following the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Well, yeah, kind of good, right? A good move taking that property, certainly making a point. But super yachts require a lot of care, and that care costs millions of dollars a year. And that is a story, well, that we get in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's going to be out later this week. It's also the Bloomberg Big Take, because what's really interesting is who's actually paying for all of this. Let's get to it with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. He's in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. The story by Bloomberg News Financial Investigation senior writer Stephanie Baker. She is via Zoom in London. This is like a delicious story.
Oh, yeah. Super yachts?
Yes.
Can't not make those fun, right? And, you know, what's really fascinating about this story, you could attempt to write this off as an oligarch story, although, as Stephanie will point out, oligarch is not the preferred word, because not all of these individuals are like textbook definitions of oligarchs, but they are, by and large, very rich Russians who don't directly own these boats. And so that gets into a really complicated topic that Stephanie dives into in the story. But more importantly, you know, there was this thing that happened that basically the moment that the war with between Russia and Ukraine happened, these yachts almost had like targets on them as countries like the US and European nations went after them. And so there's more than a few that have been basically confiscated. And Stephanie, who's paying for those?
Well, it depends on where they are. In the U.S. and Italy, it is taxpayers that are footing the bill for maintaining these super yachts. And it's not cheap to keep a super yacht, even in a port. It costs millions of dollars to keep these things staffed with crew to make sure that they are safe, you know, in case of accidents, fuel spills, fires. You know, the systems need to be run. It's not really a case of, you know, turning off the lights and locking the door and leaving it until the war in Ukraine is over. These things require a huge amount of time, effort, and money to keep in port and to make sure that they don't degrade in value, because at least in the case of the U.S., the goal of the U.S. government is for them to sell eventually some of these seized super yachts and then perhaps recoup the costs that they have shelled out on maintaining them.
Stephanie, I guess I've always learned the rule, and you'll be surprised to know that I'm not a super yacht owner, but the rule of thumb is 10% of the purchase price is your annual cost to maintain this thing, whether it's a yacht or a plane. So my question is, if I were the U.S. government, why don't I just turn around and sell these things?
Well, it's not so simple. They need to go through a complicated process called forfeiture, whereby they need to prove before a judge that this yacht has been either purchased with or involved in a crime. So it's unless there is a change of legislation to speed up this process, and there is legislation before Congress right now that would give President Biden emergency powers that would help speed this up and enable the proceeds of any sale to go to Ukraine. But short of that, it has to go through a legal process. And as Joel alluded to, in many of these cases, it's not clear who the owners are. It's not a straightforward case of, oligarch X owns yacht Y. It's the Russian billionaires tend to use very complicated shell companies. They have a tendency, and I'm speaking generally here, to have unwritten agreements to have others hold assets on their behalf. So establishing ownership requires actually not who is the owner on paper, but who is actually controlling the asset, who is using it, who is making decisions about it. One forfeiture expert compared it to the assets of a drug lord. U.S. government goes in and seizes the mansion of a drug lord, but in many cases, it's not the drug lord that owns the property on paper. It's his girlfriend.
I love that.
So they need to go through this process of establishing who is actually the owner, and it's not such a straightforward issue.
Okay, so the story opens with some reporting about the Amadea, which is a super yacht that is parked in San Diego. I thought how the U.S. got it was a great way to start the story. Can you put us on the front lines of how that went down?
Yes. Yeah, so Amadea is a $325 million super yacht that sailed on the day that Russia invaded Ukraine from St. Martin in the Caribbean to Fiji, wow, where it was frozen by Fiji authorities at the request of the U.S. government. And what proceeded was several weeks of legal wrangling until a court in Fiji approved the U.S. request to seize it. The U.S. Marshals Service turned around, hired a company to sail it to U.S. waters, where it's been sitting in the port of San Diego since June.
I want that job, by the way. Yeah. Like, can you go to Fiji and like get the super yacht and like tow it to the U.S.?
Have you not seen Below Decks?
Yeah.
It can happen. Right. It can happen. Anyway, go ahead.
But in the process, they grilled many crew members as part of this process of establishing who was really using this yacht, who was controlling it, who was directing it, and, you know, hauled various crew members, including the captains, aside, one in LA airport, the other captain hauled aside in an air-conditioned shipping container in Fiji and questioned them for hours to try to establish, who was really using it. So it shows the extent that the U.S. government has gone to really go after and chase down the assets of sanctioned Russians, many of whom were actually sanctioned in 2018, and the U.S. government did very little to enforce those sanctions.
Okay, Stephanie, you got to go to a few rarefied places, even step on some boats that are in this caliber. I shouldn't even call them boats. They're super yachts. Yes. What's it like?
They are. It's incredible, actually. It's kind of mind-boggling. I did go on one of the biggest, most luxurious super yachts. Did not feature in my story. Owned by a German billionaire. I saw it at the Monaco Yacht Show. It was bobbing off the, anchored off the port of Monaco in not great weather. I felt a bit ill by the end of it, but it was just astonishing. I mean, these are floating mansions, of the most opulent wealth. I mean, hand-painted bathrooms, artwork, pools, curved bars, spas, these things are, classic sort of over the top wealth. And, they're owned not just by Russian billionaires, right? There are billionaires all around the world who own these things, and it has become a status symbol to have them.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And a great read because you get into so many details. Stephanie Baker, thank you so much. Financial Investigations, senior writer at Bloomberg News, Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You know, I feel like, Paul, when it comes to China specifically, you see some enthusiasm and then you see it back off depending on whether or not China is getting away from its COVID zero policy. It seems like it's not, though.
It seems like it's not. And, you wonder how long can this go on? You could argue that it's an indefinite loop. Unless they get a vaccine somewhere, somehow, this is going to continue.
Right. We heard our Mark Gurman talk about it in terms of iPhone production. Let's see what David Riedel has to say about it. Back with us, delighted to have with him for another gut check when it comes to Asia, emerging, and China specifically. David Riedel is president and founder of Riedel Research Group. He joins us on the phone, actually via Zoom, in San Francisco. David, how are you?
Very well, Carol. How are you?
Doing okay, doing okay. So where are we when we look at China specifically? It does feel like we go back and forth. We're still kind of reeling a little bit off of, what was it now, 2 weeks ago, when President Xi kind of laid it out for us in terms of, it felt like the party politics trumping all. Where are we, though, in terms of how you look at China specifically?
Yeah, I was really hoping that coming out of those important political meetings a couple of weeks ago, Xi would have a more moderate approach to the zero COVID policy. I think it's really starting to wear on the population there, and it's certainly having a big negative impact on the economy. But they're really sort of doubling down on it. Beijing was quoted overnight as saying that their approach has been right, it's been cost effective, it's been effective, and it looks like it's here to stay, at least for the foreseeable future.
David, now that we have Mr. Xi in for another 5 years at least, is China, I mean, the rhetoric kind of noticed coming out of the meeting, I kind of walked away thinking, boy, if I'm a CEO with lots of assets in China, I think I got to write them down to zero. I mean, can you do business? Can anyone do sizable business in China?
You know, it's impossible to say that you refuse to trade with the second largest economy in the world. you know, very fast growing middle class, very fast growing consumer class. China cannot simply be ignored. But from an equity investor point of view, it's hard to make the argument that you would be going into China right now. We had a big rally last week on this unverified rumor of an unsigned WeChat message that indicated that they were going to ease up on zero COVID. And of course, that turned out to not be the case. There were similar rumors a few weeks ago that Xi was under house arrest, and it was all this stuff turned out to be not the case. So I think people are looking for some sort of rebound in China. And I'm afraid I don't see it really coming this year or maybe into next. Well, so I think equity investors need to sit on the side for now.
Well, and what is your kind of net-net when it comes to it, bottom line? I mean, our Andy Brown used to be editorial director for Bloomberg New Economy, and he is now really looking at the space from an outside company. But what's interesting is I said to him, you know, what's the mission here? I mean, are they kind of really giving up their economy going forward? And he's like, no, you know, President Xi isn't going to let the Chinese economy fall off a cliff. Do you agree with that? That ultimately he's going to make sure that there's growth and that there's momentum.
There does need to be growth. There needs to be food on the table. There needs to be job security in China, but for the Chinese. So I think the difference is he's not going to disappoint the Chinese people, but he might disappoint foreign investors. I would be very wary of being in some of these U.S. listed Chinese names where I feel like the Chinese have changed their tune a little bit. They've secured the capital they needed from international markets to grow certain parts of their economy. And I worry they're going to prioritize Chinese citizens over foreign investors. That's what concerns me.
And, you know, I guess my question, you know, again, going back to some of the rhetoric coming out of that meeting in China, is it seems like Mr. Xi really does want to focus almost exclusively on China and China itself. I'm not sure if I even have somebody who's going to pick up the phone on the other side if I want to trade with them. I can't imagine that's kind of where they want to go over the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, I think that they've seen with the Russia-Ukraine situation the benefits of Russia's quote-unquote fortress economy, where they had really sort of ring-fenced themselves to the extent that they could in advance of sanctions that they were expecting. I continue to believe that China will take a run at Taiwan at some point. The U.S. State Department has said they expect that to happen this decade. I'm not sure it's that soon, but I think it's probably in our lifetimes. And I think that China is trying to get themselves ready for the inevitable sanctions and pressure that would come as a result of some major move against Taiwan. So I think they're focusing on China as their top three priorities are China, China, and China. Yeah, I think that's where they're focusing.
David, we have about a minute, and then we're going to take a break and come back and talk some more. But I do wonder, when you look around the world at the Asia-Pac region, is there another area of the world that you think we should be paying more attention to than China, potentially, when it comes to tensions or concerns?
Well, I think that I'm very surprised that people aren't paying attention to the North Korean tensions that have risen in the last few weeks over the weekend and late last week. A lot of missile tests. A lot of fighter jets scrambled, both U.S., South Korean, and North Korean warplanes in the air. I'm a little surprised this Monday we're not hearing more about that. But I think there are some good opportunities in other parts of Asia. We continue to recommend Indonesia as a very strong, well-positioned regional hub. They had nearly 6% GDP growth on their last measure. And I think that Indonesia is one we're going to be talking about for a while.
David, I want to run by a pitch that I received on Friday that was kind of compelling to me. What basically the pitch is, go long India. You know, we all know some of the growth characteristics of India, but the latest one is that China is effectively shutting itself off from outside investment. And hey, if you can't go to China, try us at India. What do you think of that one?
There's really some truth to that. India has very attractive demographics, a large young population. They do have the capacity to take on some of that manufacturing capacity that people might be looking for to move out of China. India's accomplished a lot of great things in the last few years. They're very business oriented now. They've digitized large parts of the economy. A lot of advances in money transfer technology and financial fintech sort of names in India. Stocks in India are expensive. You have to really accept a higher valuation. But in terms of where the world's headed, India is a good place for people to land.
Hey, David, can it completely do kind of a replacement of the relationships that currently exist with China? Or we can't necessarily think that it's something that can just be replaced so easily?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to move those very well-established supply chains out of somewhere like a China. The advantage of manufacturing in China is these large pools of labor, but also all your other suppliers are nearby. The person who the factory for your cardboard boxes is down the street, or the packing material is in the next town over. Maybe the screens are made in a factory nearby. The ecosystem of Chinese manufacturing is very well developed. I think any opportunities in India would be individual, smaller scale manufacturing opportunities, but still could be an important safety valve for manufacturers looking to diversify away from China.
David, you know, you guys have folks on the ground, and Paul and I were talking kind of off air about how we're increasingly see people who were so entrenched, whether it was China, whether it was Hong Kong, you know, moving away, you know, physically leaving. And that says something very significant after maybe being there for decades. So what is it that you think the Bloomberg audience really needs to understand about folks? Here's what's changing, and that's not something that's likely to go back anytime soon when it comes to China specifically and or Hong Kong.
Yeah, I think that's a very important observation. China is very China-focused now. I think China feels like they have gotten from the rest of the world many of the advantages that they needed. They needed technical capability. They needed capital. They needed financial wherewithal, the ability to run large-scale banks and things like that. And they got all that. The American banking conglomerates went in there in a big way and set up these large privately run banks in China. They got the investments that they needed in Alibaba and Baidu and other companies that they listed in New York. And increasingly, you're seeing those listings move to Hong Kong or to Shanghai. So I really think you are seeing China pull back from the world stage a little bit and really focus on their domestic market, their domestic needs, and their domestic citizens. So that's what's changed. I think China is turning more inward.
Do you think the Chinese people want to turn more inward? Is there support for Xi in this evolution, I guess?
There is support for Xi. I hope he did. I worry that he might be too committed to the zero COVID policy, which can be very trying for families and for citizens and for people under a constant threat of lockdown. There's been some very high profile cases that went viral recently of families being separated and some very, very difficult stories hearing about COVID. But they are supportive of the party and they're supportive of Xi in that he's brought relative stability, he's brought food security, he's brought jobs and opportunity over the last 10 years. So I think that they'll give him a little bit more time to prove himself. I hope he doesn't trip over this zero COVID policy, which is really not working.
Hey, David, you know, shame on the world that did everybody miss some sign when it came to China and President Xi or no?
No, those of us who were watching, we knew he had a strong military bent, a very nationalistic bent. His desire to really establish Xi thought as a parallel, it's sort of on the same level as Mao Zedong thought. He really had high aspirations for his place in Chinese history, and he's executing on that plan. I think that Westerners often don't believe politicians when they say they're going to do something. And I always caution our clients, when the Chinese say they're going to do something, believe them, because they do tend to do it.
Always appreciate your time. I know we didn't get to some of the names that you are looking at, but hopefully we can do that again real soon with you. And we do appreciate the big picture talk, because I think it's just one of our big, we talk about pivots. It certainly feels like this is a big pivot of our time. David, thank you so much. Be well. David Riedel, president and founder of Riedel Research Group, joining us via Zoom in San Francisco.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com. Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Kyle, did you know that I'm an avid municipal bond investor?
I know. You talk about them a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm probably the biggest individual creditor to the state of New Jersey at this point. So I love talking muni bonds. Matt Miller, not so much. He tends to literally leave the studio when we have our sponsored municipal bond segment. You know, but we're going to speak to another bond person that loves the muni space, Nick Venditti, Senior Portfolio Manager on the Municipal Fixed Income Team at Allspring Global Investments, joining us on the phone from Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, home of Ann Miletti, too, my all-time fave. Hey, Nick, talk to us about your municipal bond markets. So we've got a Federal Reserve that has been very clear about raising interest rates. They have been raising rates. The question about when they may pause. How's your market kind of reacted to that over, you know, the past 11 months or so?
Well, it's been tough, right? It's been tough for everyone, but we're kind of in the no pain, no gain scenario. We've felt the pain, and now it's time for the gain. Absolute yields here look very, very attractive in munis, and I would say even in a tough year, munis have outperformed just about every other asset class there is, and I think they're well poised to continue to do that over the next 6 to 9 months or so.
Talk to us about, it sounds like you're giving us some visibility, but longer term, your expectations in terms of where the economy goes, where rates go, and how that impacts, in particular, when it comes to municipal, the fixed income area.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Fed seems dead set on continuing down this path, but I'm less sort of sanguine on their ability to be as aggressive in the future as they have been in the recent past. We're seeing signs of economic slowdown already, right? I mean, it seems like you can't open the news without another company announcing layoffs or hiring freezes. We're seeing mortgage rates at or above 7%. We're seeing some signs that inflation is starting to turn over. And by virtue of all of those things, I think we are slowing down the economy. And ultimately, a slower economy leads to a less aggressive Fed and should provide a pretty interesting backdrop for fixed income generally.
All right. So, you know, we're going to have our Federal Reserve here raising interest rates and the economy is slowing, as you mentioned. Talk to us about credit quality. I guess even during, you know, in the depths of the you know, coming out of the pandemic, it seemed like the stimulus was enough to really support the municipal bond market. Is that still the case? Is STIMI still supporting, you know, some of these credits?
Yeah, it turns out that nothing on earth says I love you like cash. And stimulus money was a direct injection of cash onto municipal balance sheets and income statements. And all of that cash has hid a lot of sins and frankly allowed these credits to, I would say, weather this storm probably better than they otherwise would have, and leaves them in a place still to this day where they look pretty fundamentally strong.
Hey, one thing I want to ask you, right? Got midterms tomorrow, and voters tomorrow will weigh on at least $66 billion of bond measures put forth by states and municipalities across the U.S., right? They're looking to finance things like new schools, climate resiliency efforts. That is more than double the $27 billion on ballots at this time last year. So it's among the highest volume of bonds up for votes since at least 2009. That's according to our own Bloomberg analysis here. So when you look at some of the issues that voters might be weighing on, is there anything of interest in particular for you?
You know, I think generally this is a less interesting election than,
really?
Than the prior one for,
okay.
for obvious reasons. The big, I would say, hot button issue is the one that you addressed, which is the impact it may have on supply. So ultimately, we've been living in a municipal bond world where supply has been incredibly muted. And that has acted as sort of a buoy to the muni market, even in a year where markets have been very difficult. Ultimately, if some of this excess supply comes to fruition, I think that is a weight that investors need to be aware of, and ultimately could act as a little bit of a detriment to sort of my fixed income thesis.
Hey, Nick, I know in the municipal bond market, they kind of issue bonds, municipalities, when they need the dough, not necessarily when rates are low. So what's the visibility on new issuance in your market?
At least for the rest of the year, it looks like supply is going to remain very, very muted. And again, part of that is a direct result of all of that stimulus money. All of that cash has allowed municipalities to sort of kick the can one block further down the road. So it should remain, the backdrop should remain pretty strong from a supply perspective over the next 8 weeks or so. It'll be interesting to see how munis sort of react to this new higher rate environment and how they, come to the market and structure their debt on a go-forward basis given these new realities.
And I always like to ask about the taxable municipal bond market, because that is an oxymoron to me. The main reason, if not the only reason, I own all this New Jersey paper, because it's triple tax free income. But talk to us about the taxable municipal space.
So the taxable muni market really became in vogue when tax-exempt munis lost the ability to advance refund their debt in the tax-exempt market. So they started tapping the taxable market pretty aggressively and still recognized economic savings. A perfect storm kind of came to fruition because all of a sudden demand for taxable munis skyrocketed as well when tax rates for institutional investors fell during the Tax Reform Act. Now, though, we're living in a world where tax-exempt munis cannot recognize economic savings. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not the supply dynamic we've seen over the last couple of years will be able to persist on a go-forward basis. I think it's probably likely that it won't, and taxable munis will once again shrink to a fraction of the total market.
Hey, Nick, just got about 25 seconds here. So if investors are looking to put some money into the municipal bond market, where would you say or suggest that they maybe think about looking at? And just quickly.
Yeah, I would say two things. One, look, duration as a risk is certainly cheaper with rates as high as they are.
Yep.
But with the curve as funky shaped as it currently is, I would still take a little bit of a prudent stance towards duration.
And okay.
Similar on credit. We're entering a recession. Got spreads it. Are likely to widen.
All right. We got to run. Nick Venditti. He is at Allspring Global Investments.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie's based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.